And good morning to you. Welcome to Life Matters across the nation on ABC RN. For the next hour, Natasha Mitchell, very pleased to be with you. I had a really lovely experience last night at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne with Christine and Paul Bryden. Christine was a high flyer, a science policy trailblazer, a single mother of three young daughters when, back in 1995, at 46, she was diagnosed with early onset dementia, and that must surely be the biggest shock you can imagine at that stage of your life. And yet, 20 years later, she is thriving, she is surviving, and she and Paul have this incredible story to tell. They've become really powerful advocates for those living with dementia, and I'm going to bring you that whole conversation on Life Matters on Monday, because I know the event was booked out, so some of you will be very interested to know that we'll be airing it, and it'll go up on the Wheeler Centre website too as a video. This morning on the program, two equally stunning stories of lives redefined, intimate stories, stories of living large. Harold Hillman forged a successful career in the US military, but something inside was deeply, deeply wrong.
You know, I had another medal on my uniform by external standards, another symbol to signify that I was excellent and outstanding. But inside, I was a hollow, empty man who had lost his soul. And that really was the defining moment for me.
Yes, Harold Hillman, quite a conversation. He now works with people to help them find their authentic voice at work, but it really stems from his own story, and he's going to join you in the second half of Life Matters this morning on fitting in and standing out at work. And you can tweet us today at RN Life Matters, our listener feedback line, for your thoughts or comments about anything you're hearing, 0283 1430, or get on our Facebook page. Well, he was the singer, songwriter, dancer, flamboyant entertainer who Australia fell in love with, the late, great Peter Allen. He died at just 48 back in 1992. If you didn't get to witness his talents then, or were born after his death, you're going to get a chance to this Sunday night. A two-part telemovie telling Peter's life story is kicking off on Channel 7. It's made by the team who also brought us the highly acclaimed Never Tear Us Apart about In Excess last year. From all reports, Not the Boy Next Door will be just as gripping. And the series focuses on Peter's early years, including his childhood in Armidale in northern New South Wales, before his father's death meant his family had to move to Tenterfield to live with his grandfather, George, a saddler. Now, as it happens, RN's own Cassie McCullough has a family connection to Peter. Indeed, he really was the boy next door, or at least the kid around the corner, for Cassie's mother and two uncles, who as kids in Armidale were very close to Peter and his family. And Cassie has asked them to remember those days with the young, and yes, even larger than life then, Peter Allen. It's a really poignant, powerful story, and here's Cassie.
There are family stories that you grow up with, stories that have been around for so long that you just take them for granted. This is one of those stories.
On a day like today, we pass the time away.
My mother, Margaret, and her two younger brothers, Jimmy and Davron, grew up with Peter Allen. He lived around the corner from them in Armidale in the 1950s. My grandmother was a desperately poor widow when, in 1952, she, Mum at 10, Jimmy 8 and Davron 6 lived in a rundown house in Faulkner Street. It was then that Uncle Jimmy met Peter, who was then called Peter Woolnough, and he was also 8 years old.
Well, I can remember pretty precisely when I met Peter. I was at home and I walked outside out of boredom, and I saw this kid across the street who called me over. And it was Peter who was there with Lynn, his sister, and they were playing on a place we used to call the Cliff, which was just soil erosion across the street from us. And so we played a game of throwing rocks, and then Mum called me in for lunch, And I went back for lunch and I forgot mostly about it. And then Mum came into my room and she said, "Did you meet a little boy this morning?" And I said, "Yes, called Peter. And he's outside, he wants you to go and play." So that was the first day that I met Peter, and that was in May of 1952.
My first memory of Peter is walking up the hill from the cinema. We used to always go to the pictures every Saturday afternoon. I was walking home by myself, and this young boy, he's 2 years younger than me, catches up and starts talking, chat, 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 and so happy, so exuberant and extrovert. It was extraordinary because we were, to some extent, ostracised in the town by more conservative people. The house we lived in was falling down. It was never repaired. Nothing was done to the garden or the house because our mother couldn't do that. And the neighbours wouldn't let their children come and play with us. The St Vincent de Paul used to come and bring food, but we never had visitors. And for someone to just approach us and talk to us like that and to be treated without prejudice was really good. And I liked him straight away. He was a strange little boy, freckled, but very happy, very laughing. He brought happiness to our childhood.
That's my mum, Margaret. Uncle Davron, who, 63 years later, still lives in Armidale, also remembers the moment he first met Peter.
Our house was on top of a hill, very old, and Peter lived around the corner about a block away, I suppose. And what I remember was one day this boy and his sister came walking around the corner and started talking to us. And it was Peter and Lynn, his sister. And from then on, we became friends and we knocked around. We used to make up movies as we're on. We'd act out parts of a movie through and all this sort of thing. Then we'd tell horror stories. We'd all end up out the backyard scared to death. We'd frighten ourselves out of the house. At times there was six of us in a group playing around the neighbourhood and going down to the park down the bottom of the hill. There were willow trees and the creek used to flood. Peter was very friendly. He was very exciting about things. Life was exciting for him. And he was learning the piano and learning how to tap dance and sing and that. And he was always joyful about things, you know.
It was the time when rock and roll was starting. So Bill Haley and the Comets and Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard and people like that were coming over the airwaves. We used to, if somebody went on holidays, the other, like Peter, used to direct all this and produce it. When we come back, they'd have a little play, Welcome Home, for us, with Peter on piano and Lynn dancing and little comedy acts and things like that. And from that evolved the skiffle group. At that time, the English skiffle movement had started with Chris Barber's band with a fella called Lonnie Donegan, who sang things like My Old Man's a Dustman, and that was skiffle. And they had a washboard and they had a teacher's bass and various other little improvised instruments. So we decided it would have been Peter as the main person involved in getting it going. We decided to start a skiffle band, and he actually had a washboard at home, which he gave me, and I'd play that with thimbles, and that was how the band started. And that was heavily promoted by Marion and Dick. And Dick in particular, this is, Peter's father, was very proud of that, and was very keen to see that this skiffle group get going. And Marion was, she used to go down to the New England Hotel, or Man's Hotel, which is now called the Dewey, I think. And that's where we eventually came to play there as a skiffle group.
Oh, my old man's a dustman, he wears a dustman's hat. He wears gold blimey trousers, and he lives in the council flat. He looks a proper...
Who was in the band? Peter was playing the piano. Graham Heffron was playing the T-chess bass. Jimmy was on the washboard. And I was playing the the shakers. They were homemade ones. Sand filled in tins. Golden syrup, that's the one. To shake, you know. We had a little ukulele. I used to strum and we used to all sing.
It's no secret in our family that my mother can't hold a tune. So it's rather amazing that for one of the band's first proper gigs, she was encouraged by Dick Woolnough to be the main singer.
I can't sing, so I wasn't going to be in it, except that Dick, Peter's father, at one point coerced me into singing, attempting to sing at a performance at the golf club. So I just mouthed the words. I didn't sing. And of course, people must have known, but I thought I might have got away with it. But I have a good memory of that because on that occasion, Dick said, "Would I like a drink from the bar?" And he knew I was underage. And he went up to the bar and he bought me a lemon squash and brought it back to me. And it was the most beautiful thing I had ever tasted. It was so delicious and sweet and strong. And then Dick, who was a kind man, kind to me and to my brothers, Dick said, "Come on, you have to dance." Well, of course, I had never been on a dance floor. I had no experience of that. We were very isolated. And he danced with me on the floor, the first man ever to dance with me. So I remember that very strongly.
Adios, amigo.
This is one of the consistent themes of the story. Mum and Jim and Davron, who grew up without their own father, have always maintained that Dick Woolnough was a very kind man, not the ogre that he's often been described as.
Look, I can remember Dick took us to see The Thing from Another World. He shouted us in and he bought us a drink afterwards and he walked us home through the willows in silence because we were absolutely terrified of the movie that we'd seen. And I still am, actually. I saw it recently. He used to, when we were at Tattersall's Hotel, when we were playing down there, Dick used to take us down there. He'd sit there and he'd walk us home. And he was very proud of Peter, actually. He loved him as a son and a piano player. But I knew that they were different personalities. Dick was introverted. And Peter was outgoing, extrovert.
I think Dick was a good bloke. He wasn't a brutal person, as some people seem to make out. I used to deliver papers around the hotels of an afternoon when I was a schoolboy. And I used to always sell Dick a paper at this certain hotel he used to go to every Friday, and he was always sitting on his own having a beer. And I thought, he's not with anyone, you know. It sort of always occurred to me. So I thought he didn't have a lot of friends there. He may have at work, you know, but I don't know.
Over the years, there was trouble in the Woolnough household, though. In 1958, when Jim and Peter were both 14, things took a turn for the worse.
I didn't know what was going on within the family. I didn't realise that the family had broken up. And I went over one Friday night to see Peter, and I knocked on the back door, and Dick answered the door. And I said, "Is Peter there?" He said, "He's not here." And the place was heavy with smoke, and I think I could smell alcohol, I think. And he just slammed the door, which was unlike him. And I went home and I said to Mum, and told her the story, and she said, "I should have told you that the children have left." Now, it was a fortnight after that that I was... It was some sort of thing going on in Armidale where they were let all these balloons out of a plane, and in one of them there was a £10 note, which was a huge amount of money. And we were all over near the racecourse trying to find the balloon with the money in it. And when I was coming back, I ran into Jenny Wallace, who knew Peter very well, and she said to me, "Did you hear that Dick shot himself?" That's what her words were, and I said, "No." And that was a Saturday. So it was a Saturday afternoon that I learnt that. And I was not with Peter. Peter was not with us.
That Saturday, Peter was at the cinema when the bad news arrived.
Well, Peter said that during the movie, somehow on the projector, they'd put a note up, could so-and-so come to the box office? And I can't remember exactly what he said, whether the police were there or someone was there, but they informed him that there was a tragedy. And he said to me that he went and watched the rest of the movie. Now, I don't know whether that is true or not, but that's what he said to me.
Dick borrowed the gun from Frank Groh next door, saying he needed to shoot the dog who had gone mad. Do you remember that, Jim?
That was the story, yeah.
Yeah.
I only saw him over at the showground, and he said to me, Daddy shot himself. That's what he said to me. Well, I didn't know what to say. It was a shock to me, you know.
Time is a traveller, tender field saddler, turn your head. Ride again, Jackaroo, think I see kangaroo up ahead. The son of George Wolno went off and got married and had a war baby. Something was wrong, and it's easier to drink than go crazy. And if there were questions about why the end was so sad, well, George had no answers about why a son ever has need of a gun.
I never saw Peter again. After that, he left Armidale after that, went to stay at his grandfather's place in Tenterfield, and never saw him again from that age, from that day, except on the screen.
Jimmy and Davron did see Peter again after that Saturday, very soon after Dick's death. Peter, his mother Marion and sister Lynn would eventually move to Tenterfield, where they lived with George, Dick's father. And the contents of the house on Donnelly Street were auctioned off.
Yeah, we were there the day that they were preparing, or Peter was preparing to sell all his books and that. So that's how quickly they moved out of the place. So he was putting boxes out in the back lawn, and that was the preparation for an auction. Davron was there, but Peter came earlier in the day, came over and got me and said, come with me, I want to show you something. So he took me over to their place in Donnelly Street, and he took me into the room and showed me where Dick had committed suicide. And there was still blood on the wall and that, but he said, see what he did. I think he was just letting something out to me.
Oh, time is a metal, ten of your saddle, I make your bed. Fly away, cockatoo, down on the ground, emu up ahead. Time is a tale teller, Tenterfield saddle, turn your head. Ride again, Jackaroo, think I...
He did come back to Armidale once, on one occasion. He came to see us. But by then he'd already started playing music on the Gold Coast. He was very proud of what he was doing, and he was sort of all enthusiastic about the prospects of a musical career. He was destined for that anyway. He was destined for that right from the very first time I met him. And, yes, he was very proud and very actually skiting about it, yes. He was. And I was sort of excited too. I thought that was wonderful.
When my baby smiles at me, I go to Rio de Janeiro, Mau Mio.
There wasn't gay in those days. Mm. People were sort of, if they were like that, they were sissies.
No, they were girly. We didn't know about gay. He was girly.
He was girly. But he, I can remember him throwing a ball. He'd throw it awkwardly.
And he'd sort of sashay around, wriggling his hips and shoulders.
Yeah. If he had his hands on his hips, his elbows were ladylike. His hip was stuck out a little bit, very feminine.
But he was quite athletic.
Knowing Peter as a child enriched our childhood, because there's no one else who was so inclusive to us in that town. And then the added benefit of his piano playing, his creativity, the games we made up together, the things we invented and the props we made. He would always encourage me. Oh, you are so nimble with your fingers, the way you make that. I remember him saying that, and that was important.
Well, I'm very glad I knew Peter because he was a good friend and I enjoyed the times we had together.
We used to go over to Peter's place. They'd always make us feel welcome, all of them, Marion, Dick, Lynn. And that was sort of, that was a bit different. We were really accepted there. They were broad-minded and they were nice. We liked Marion, we liked Dick, and we liked the family. So it was, it was a nice little part of life, yes. Someday we'll all be together once more. Oh, I still call Australia. I still call Australia. I still call Australia.
Such incredible talent. The late, great Peter Allen busting a gut on stage as he did. Those lungs, that presence. And we heard reminiscences there from our own Cassie McCullough's mother, Margaret Marsh, and her uncles Jimmy and Davron Fletcher, who grew up with Peter in Armidale back in the 1950s. Davron, there's a little footnote here about what happened to all of those kids and Cassie's family members. Davron became an electrician and still lives in Armidale, and he has a daughter, Arlene, who is a professional double bass player, so the music lives on. Margaret, Cassie's mum, went on to become an architect and an art teacher and a painter, so her creative juices kept flowing. Jim became a jazz drummer of considerable note and still plays gigs every weekend in the pubs and clubs around Sydney. And thank you, big thanks to Cassie McCullough for producing that wonderful story from her own family archive. She is, of course, the presenter of RN's The List, and the telly movie Not the Boy Next Door airs from this weekend on Channel 7. So we look forward to catching that. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning across the nation on ABC RN. Life Matters is where you are. Another incredible and profound personal story coming up next.
Has anyone else suggested that you're a weirdo?
It's probably not something that you say to someone when you first meet them. I think people find it a little strange.
Do you find taxidermy creepy and strange? What about having your pet preserved? Mandy had her cat of 18 years taxidermied after it died.
I think it's strange because it's something that's not in our culture, in our everyday life.
Pet Taxidermy on Animal People with me, Sarah Lestrange, Sunday afternoon at 3:30.
Yeah, I love Animal People with Sarah Lestrange. Would I get my dog taxidermied? I'm not sure. She's quite a big wolfhound, and I'm not sure that that would be such a good thing to have sitting in the lounge room. Oh, dear. Look, how do you fit in at work? Have you made a conscious effort to assimilate, to fit in with the team? Or are you often one who stands out, who speaks out? Do you have that urge to be an agent of change? Maybe you worry that you fit in too well, that you're taken for granted and that your individual talents or potential are going unnoticed, that you've lost your voice at work. Psychologist and leadership trainer Harold Hillman knows this tension all too well. It's a subject of a new book of his called Fitting In, Standing Out, Finding Your Authentic Voice at Work. And he talks from a personal place too, drawing on his own conflicted career experiences of trying to fit in. Because you see, for many years, Harold lived his life, as he describes it, in the closet, as a gay man acting straight. He married, he had children, he trained as a psychologist, and then things got more complicated even again. He joined the military. He even got to the point of becoming a member of the task force commissioned by the Clinton administration at the time in 1993 to end discrimination against gay citizens wanting to serve openly in the US military. And that became the turning point for Harold. He's also the author of The Imposter Syndrome, and he joined me a little earlier in the Life Matters studio.
Good morning, Natasha.
It is the ultimate tension, isn't it? Fitting
it is.
In and standing out at work.
That's right. These are not isolated extremes. There's a beautiful inherent tension between the two. I make the premise in the book that there's a greater gravitational pull towards fitting in. And even in companies and in organizations, we have formal inductions to help the new person fit in as quickly as possible. 90 days is the sort of the general zone where we consider it that a person will be going through those gates of fitting in. But certainly within 90 days, we want you settled in and we want the noise around you to be minimal. And therein lies a big part of the problem. Do we fit in so well that we really render ourselves irrelevant because we've toned down, we've quieted down around those things that would have us stand out? Mm-hmm. Very often when new people come into a company, they're seeing things that we can't see because we're so fully immersed in it. But the expectation is that you'll get in here and you'll get in quickly and you'll get in quietly and settle in. And so it's much harder for people to actually stand out.
And yet all that fitting into an existing social order in a workplace, and many things go into building that social order, all that is contrary to the modern mantra of innovation.
That's
in workplaces.
Right. It really is.
Rock and a hard place.
It really is. You see, a lot of organizations have innovation, diversity, you know, be your own person, authenticity as values. Mm. But it's hard when you get in there to all of a sudden point at the social order and all of the values and norms that define that. And, you know, sort of pick at it because those norms and values are reinforced by a lot of the leaders and a lot of people who buy into it. So there's something when you voluntarily walk into an organization and say, I want to belong here, there's an implicit expectation that you're also buying into the way we do things around here.
If you walk in and yes, you want to belong, but you observe what needs to change, what could change, and you say it.
That's right.
Well, that has all sorts of implications.
It does.
And it can totally unravel for you.
It can. And sometimes it is a matter of whether or not the team perceives that you've sat in the seat long enough. And so there is this thing around when you're trying to fit in, you really do need to show respect for what you're joining. Sometimes we come in as the avowed change agent. And so there's this expectation that we're not going to buy in to the way we do things around here. Our goal is to push at it. Mm. When people perceive that you're pushing at what they have spent a lot of time building,
it's personal.
It is very personal.
Well, this whole story is intensely personal for you.
Yeah.
And there you were fitting in a big way for
big
much
time.
Of your career.
That's
in the
right.
US Air Force.
Yes.
How did you fit in?
Look, I lost the plot in what I call an existential moment in my life. I knew I was gay as a teenager, but I didn't feel safe being gay. I grew up in an African-American neighborhood in Washington, D.C., where it just wasn't safe to be out. And that was made known. And so I learned by the time I was, in my late teens, certainly as I was coming of age as an adult, that it just made the noise go away if I fit in and just assume the straight lifestyle. People were less anxious around me. People seemed a lot more comfortable whenever I showed up with a girl. You know, when I showed up with the woman who would eventually become my wife, I remember the sighs of relief and, you know, oh my goodness gracious, he's worked through that phase. You know, he's
because
now,
people had a sense.
That's right. People had a sense. And look, I had conversations with my parents who, out of love, just did not want me subjected to the horrors that we witnessed around us. So, look, I just decided that it was easier for me to fit in and just be who people wanted me to be.
It's one thing to fit in. It's another to then enter the U.S. Air Force.
That's right.
Where fitting in was mandatory to a whole other extent. What was it like for you living in that and working in that context and living the lie that you were living?
Look, I didn't really anticipate that it was going to be that much different. I had lied all my life about being gay, but I had never seen it on an application where you had to actually deny that you were gay. So that was very different for me. That was a bit confronting, but I did. I just going into the military.
So you ticked that box.
I ticked that box.
I am not gay.
I am not gay. And again, I didn't think it would be much of an issue because I was just going in for 3 years to get some management experience, then I was going to step out of the military. But look, they considered me an outstanding, exemplary officer. And because of that, I got invited to then participate on this commission that would determine whether or not gay people could actually serve openly in the military. So that lie that I had been telling all my life that I had just sort of washed off as, well, that's just what you do, now took me right into the eye of an existential storm where for 3 months I was sequestered as part of this task force where we were going to decide if people like me could actually serve openly.
So what sorts of conversations did you bear witness to in those months?
Yeah, look, it was...
That ultimately unraveled you.
It was quite confronting, Natasha. There were pro-gay groups and anti-gay groups as part of this consultation process who would come in to present evidence why gays, in the case of anti-gay groups, why gay people should not be able to serve openly. And there I sat listening to this testimony depicting gay people as immoral, unethical, twisted, criminal, sick, untrustworthy.
And that's no exaggeration of what was said.
That's no exaggeration. And this time it wasn't just about hypothetical gay people. This was about me. I was invited to participate on this panel because I was an outstanding officer. And yet here they were presenting evidence that suggested that people like me couldn't possibly be outstanding in service to their country. One of the things that was most confronting was when pro-gay groups came in, the head panel would put a bowl of fruit right in the middle of the table. It was an inside joke for all of us on the panel to put a bowl of fruit for the fruits who were coming in. And I would sit there and I would look on the other side of that bowl of fruit at very courageous people who I didn't have the courage to be like them, who came in to lean into that adversity to make it okay for people like me sitting there closeted to be able to serve. And that's when I really just thought, look, I can no longer live a life where I have turned off my very persona just to fit in and be accepted and be deemed acceptable by people who would prefer that I just turn the noise down on my own persona.
Harold Hillman is with us this morning. He is a consultant, a managing director of a consultancy that coaches business leaders and executive teams. He's the author of Fitting In, Standing Out. And as you can hear, it's a very personal theme for him. The outcome of that commission was no step forward. It was don't ask, don't tell.
That's where don't ask
legislation.
That's right. Don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue. So gay people still couldn't serve openly. The witch hunts would go away. At least those would stop. But many people considered it actually to be a setback with respect to gay people being able to serve openly and to serve with integrity.
It was a legislative endorsement of prejudice.
It really was. It was. It was. Whereas before it had been unofficial, now it was official. And that really was the catalyst for me to get my life together.
So how did you do that? Take us back to that moment where you just went, okay, here's how I'm going to do this.
Look, I remember that it was a searing moment when I got back to the U.S. Air Force Academy and the department was gathered together and I was being presented with a medal for my service on this commission. And as Colonel Hughes read the citation and pinned the medal on me, I will never forget. It was the first time that a biblical scripture really resonated with me quite personally. For what shall it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his own soul? And I felt like, you know, I had another medal on my uniform by external standards, another symbol to signify that I was excellent and outstanding. But inside, I was a hollow, empty man who had lost his soul. And that really was the defining moment for me, where I went and sat down with my wife of 13 years and had the most difficult conversation I'll ever have in my life. And that was to say, look, this is who I am. This is who I need to be, and we need to redefine who we are. It was a sad period. It was a tough period for my ex-wife. My daughters were 11 and 9. Years later, my daughters often sit and talk to me about how proud they are of me for taking the step to become a whole person.
So they understand that now.
They understand that now. I have two beautiful daughters in their 30s. I have a grandson. Mm-hmm. And my daughters love to tell their friends about me. They love to tell the story about their father. And I think that's the ultimate sign that it's all been worth it, because they have a whole father. I'm no longer compartmentalized and where I've turned off a big part of my persona, my personality, just to be deemed acceptable.
So it's interesting that you take your own story into this work that you do with businesses.
That's right.
And working on individual authenticity all different ways. Yes, it might be about one's sexuality. It might be about how one drives change in a workplace in a way that is true to what they see, what vision they have for a working environment. It can operate in many different ways.
So
this tension that you explore in this new book, Fitting In, Standing Out, what you're trying to guide people towards is a sweet spot.
That's right.
Which is?
Yeah, that sweet spot is that point on the continuum where you have not lost yourself and you have not lost others. That you actually realize that there's a correlation between other people finding you quite compelling if, in fact, they sense that you are coming from a place of integrity where you're not afraid to go out on a limb and be out there by yourself, but they sense that it's that important to you. And even if they can't agree with the position you're taking, there is something about a person who backs him or herself to the point that others actually see the character behind it. And that sweet spot is one, and it'll be different for different people, somewhere on that continuum.
Depending on your personality
depending
and how people
your,
receive you in the workplace.
That's right. And that's why it really ultimately is about authenticity. It'll be different for different folks. Some folks are just a little quieter than others. But when we get to the point where we have turned our voice or our perspective down or even off, there's some highly paid, very senior people in organizations who've become very quiet because the lifestyle has entrapped them in this sense of, hey, I can't disturb the status quo. It's a long way to fall from, you know, a position of comfort and those types of things. And I see it all the time. And I really, really, my goal is to have people appreciate that when you turn your perspective off, you're not really doing what you joined to do.
Let's look at how things can operate, because you suggest that people should endeavor to fit in first.
Yes, that's right.
So give us an example of that and then how that then lays the path for generating change, for standing out in
That's
the way
right.
that you feel the need to.
That's right. When you voluntarily join an organization, if you haven't been part of an acquisition or a merger where you just find yourself all of a sudden in an organization, but when you go through the interview process and do your homework and decide to go in, there is something associated with going in to show respect for what you're joining, that people have put a lot of time and committed a lot of themselves into what you're joining. So sometimes when we go in and we're very critical and taking shots at people and the way things are around here, we don't realize that people's egos and sense of self and worth and all of that are attached to what you're joining. It's like joining a new family where you may marry someone of different ethnicity background, where there are different customs, and if you go in and just sort of dismiss them as irrelevant or show disrespect, that really doesn't position you then to be able to then stand out in a way. You have to go in and show respect for what you're joining.
Now that sounds intuitive, and people do that, but even when they do that, then the effort of standing out comes unstuck.
That's right. It's very, sometimes it can be simply in the language. I'm here to save you from yourselves is a completely...
Well, that'd go down like a lead balloon.
Oh, big time. It's completely different than we can be better than who we are. Mm. That sense of by standing out, the goal here is to make us all better. And here's why. And taking the time to have the team appreciate that you aren't trying to save them from themselves, that you're one of them. And what you're trying to do is move the whole dial in a material way. And so part of it is about approach and language and that mindset that in order to stand out, very often you have to earn the respect of those who then are more likely to follow you.
Which can be an immense challenge in a workplace culture that is resistant to change.
Right. That's right.
Where attitudes, where that social order has become so entrenched.
Exactly.
That people just want to stay doing it the way they've always done it. Because
absolutely.
That's comfortable.
It's
because
comfortable.
That's the rule.
It's the rule. And leaders reinforce that, Natasha.
And so there's a cynicism about change.
There really is. And I just, you know, I emphasize to leaders, be mindful about how your behaviors, how your language, how every subtle nuance around you will make a statement about whether or not it's okay to take issue with the way we do things around here. When we hire people because they think differently, and within their first 2 or 3 weeks on board, we've spent a lot of time just turning their voice down. Leadership is about disruption, and sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we tend to just sort of emphasize, get in quickly, don't disrupt things, just sort of get in here.
If there was one thing we could all do today to bring us one step closer to finding our authentic voice at work.
That's right.
What would it be?
Look, I would say pay attention to your conscience. It's a wonderful thing. It nags you for a reason. When you get up from that meeting and you leave and you go sit back at your desk and you kick yourself for a half hour because you didn't say what you wanted to say. There's a reason why you aren't saying what you want to say. People will know that. I would say pay attention to the private conversations you're having with yourself. You know when you've turned your voice down. Are you getting paid, actually, not to have a perspective?
There's a really interesting thread in this book, which I'll just squeeze in, and that is vulnerability.
That's right.
Is intrinsic to authenticity. But vulnerability is very difficult to demonstrate at work.
It is.
And it has consequences when you do that
does.
Can be long-lasting.
Absolutely. For people who struggle with being vulnerable, it means that they self-impose this pressure to be perfect. And so vulnerability is really about coming to terms with the fact that I'll never be a perfect person. And so it's okay to ask for help. It's okay not to have the perfect answer for everything. When you put pressure on yourself to be perfect, it means you start containing yourself more. You're afraid to be wrong or to have an opinion that's just not going to land in the right spot. So consequently, you start turning things down. You're much more careful. And it works against this whole thing around authenticity, where people connect better with you if you are imperfect because they can relate better to you.
Yeah.
It's hard to relate to an imperfect.
To a perfect person. That's right. Beautifully, this year, I think it was on your birthday, you came full circle. So I'll ask you about that finally. You came full circle and here you are, invited to speak to New Zealand's Air Force's Leadership Forum.
That's
about
right.
The very issues that you're talking about today.
Natasha, it was a beautiful experience. If ever there was an example of what full circle means, it was that. On my birthday, Vice Air Marshal Mike Yardley, Chief of New Zealand's Air Force, Royal New Zealand Air Force, invited me to come and to tell that story about when I was a closeted gay officer and the impact that it had on my soul, to the top 120 officers in the New Zealand Air Force. And the message that they sent to me was, "Welcome home, Major Hillman." And it was profound.
Wow.
I was so warmly received. And I just thought, life is a wonderful thing. There is just something beautiful about leaning into your own integrity, trusting yourself, backing yourself, and having people appreciate that. That was such a profound moment in my life.
Your life has a way of delivering you that poetry.
That's a wonderful. That's a wonderful way to describe it.
The poetic experience, the lived experience.
Ah, very much so.
Look, lovely to have you on the program today, and thank you very much for sharing your story as well, and thank you for the terrifically interesting book. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Natasha.
Harold Hillman, once Major Harold Hillman. He is author of Fitting In, Standing Out, and also The Imposter Syndrome. He's managing director of Sigmoid Curve Consulting Group. He's based in New Zealand, but he's often here in Australia with various clients. What a story, hey? What a story. And I just want to say, in response to the Peter Allen feature from Cassie McCullough on the show, it is World Suicide Prevention Today. Prevention Day. It is also Are You Okay Day in Australia. This is a day where we take particular care and make ourselves particularly aware of those around us who might be struggling. And if you felt that the Peter Allen program brought up some concerns for you or you're struggling, of course there's Lifeline 13 11 14, that's 131114. And yes, 131114. It's Are You Okay Day in Australia, World Suicide Prevention Day. Across the entire planet, let's reach out and look after each other. Your calls have been pouring in this week in response to two cracker discussions about education. On Wednesday, we discussed the uncertainty that remains around the proposed changes to the way unis set their fees and what that might mean if you're a student right now or a prospective student in terms of the scale of your HEX debt. And here are some calls in response.
Karen from Woiwoi. I'm just thinking that the debate's been hijacked actually by the right wing, and we need to get back to the debate about what kind of society we want. If we want an egalitarian society, the whole of advanced Western society has been based for the last 200 years on free education. We need to actually get back to free education, and that means university education these days, and to debate on that so that it's affordable for everyone that has talent and ability, and so that we can take advantage of that talent and ability in our society, because otherwise we're going to fall back behind other societies. Thank you. Bye.
Hello, it's Helen Fritz from Mount Albert. The fact that women will be having to pay the same HEX debt, you know, repayment as men, and yet because they're earning less and because they're home with family for certain periods of time, they'll end up paying a lot more money for the same education. And I just wonder why this hasn't been picked up more and discussed further. I don't even consider it a feminist issue. I think it's an important basic equity issue.
Hello, my name's Sam Macri. I live in Canberra. I'm a parent. A lot of the students, even though they've got HEX debts, the parents often have to actually accommodate their children away from where they're living, and I don't think that the government's actually fully understood this. My son is studying medicine. My son has ended up in Adelaide, and unfortunately we've got to support him and for his accommodation. So in medicine, it's about $60,000. It's a six-year course. And that's not including all the other expenses that he has to pay for, like books, which are really expensive. And I think that the government doesn't fully understand or doesn't appreciate the actual costs. Thank you.
What was missed in the university fee deregulation discussion was the fact that a lot of degrees, both undergraduate and postgraduate, are moving online. It's opening up a whole new world of online-delivered courses, both here in Australia and overseas. They're much cheaper to produce, they require less lecturers to supervise, and I think that, you know, it's going to drive costs down in the future greatly, and we really need to be cognizant of the fact that Australian universities will need to compete in that space as well.
Yes, indeed. Online degrees, MOOCs and the like. Yep, lots of interest there. Look, another topic that we looked at in relation to education was yesterday when we turned to the issue of whether or not parental choices of schools are actually creating divisions within our school system, not just socioeconomic divisions, which we know about, but also ethnic divisions, and whether that's a concern. Here are some calls.
Hi, this is Meta. I'm calling from Vaucluse, where we live in an area that is quite affluent, but my children go to Bondi Public School. And I think schools are meant to be a place where it's a reflection of society. So the ethnicity and also what I find interesting here is that we're talking about cultural divide, and yet I still find it amazing, and this is a topic you've spoken about many times, that we still separate gender in so many of the private schools, which I find extraordinary, because to me that is not a reflection of society. And so what is it we're trying to teach our children? Is it strictly academics? Should it not be something we're actually teaching them in an environment that's a reflection of the society that they live in? Thank you.
It's Jan from the Gold Coast. I've just turned 80, so I've lived through a lot of eras, and particularly I found the division in schooling on religious grounds has been with us forever. So this division on the ethnic basis, socioeconomic, they're just additions to that. And I have always believed public schooling with people in a cohesive environment with everybody and anybody from the community, that is a way to get on and relate to other people with other ideas and other backgrounds and other cultures. Queensland, in my year of growing up, didn't have many private schools. Schools have come with an influx of southerners, and Queensland's public schools I still believe in, and to stop divisiveness in society, they are the way to go. It's a pool of kids who will learn to grow up together. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I don't think a lot of Australians want to send their kids to schools where English is no longer spoken in the playground. I'm wanting to highlight, why is it that many Asian families are targeting property markets in and around free selective government schools? It's to get a free education from the system. I think a lot of families from non-Asian families find cram schools offensive. They want their kids to be well-rounded. They want sport and music in schools. And certainly a lot of the independent schools and private schools have said specifically that they do not want coached students applying. As someone who teaches in the academic sector, universities don't want kids who learn by rote. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Our listener feedback line, ring at any time and leave a message 028 333 1430, our Facebook page, our website, it's all there, and you can catch up with the audio of today's program on our website. But Michael Cathcart is here with me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. A little experiment.
Have we got you on mic?
Yes,
we have. Oh, hello.
I found myself. I found my voice.
You have. Speaking of which.
Little experiment. If I do this, keep the home fires burning, whatever the next line is. That immediately brings thoughts of
war
of the First World War. So this is a conversation that I recorded at Melbourne University just a week ago now, where three musicologists are talking about the way in which the First World War was infused with all this different kind of music. So you've got the music of nostalgia, the music of patriotism, the music of even the music of protest.
Now that's an interesting backstory that we often don't hear from the Great War.
Well, there was a song that was written by an American actually called "I Didn't Raise My Son to Be a Soldier, to Kill Some Other's Mother's Darling Boy who dares to place a gun upon his shoulder to do something." I forget how the words go, and that was used as a protest song in Australia against the war. So we're going to look at the way in which the war is evoked or evoked musics and. Music reminds us of that time.
It does indeed. Music is full of memory and nostalgia and feeling. That's Books and Arts Daily coming up after the news.